Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to a geophysicist, at least a geophysicist by training, but he uses this technology to go all around the world doing very interesting things. He's from the University of Leeds in Yorkshire in Britain, and his name is Adam Booth. And Adam, welcome very much to Science Studio.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
I'm glad you think it's going to be fun. And it has to be, in fact.
Cool. We'll see what we can do.
Lovely. So before we get into the particular branch of geophysics, if there are branches, and I know it's to do with seismology and in the main, how did you become a scientist? What earth possessed you to want to do geophysics? Geology is one thing, physics is another, and so you choose this
It's not the job title that easily rolls off the tip of the tongue, is it? Particularly when you're a seven-year-old. But I was always fascinated by kind of the dynamic Earth, you know, earthquakes and volcanoes and things like that. And always was reading books about this, always fascinated by the geography. And then for some reason, I kind of parked that for a while. And when it came to looking at university courses, I started looking at chemical engineering. And after looking at through syllabuses and prospectuses from the various different universities in the UK, I started to recognise that chemical engineering was quite a lot about designing pipes.
Pipes.
And, you know, conduits for chemicals, whether these pipes are high, you know, corrosion resistant, whether they're high pressure pipes, whatever they are, they are pipes. And I couldn't quite get inspired by the design of pipes for a living. And so I was really stuck for something. And then it was my mum who, as mums do, they interfere, they get involved with things. She was looking through these prospectuses and said, you know, what about this geophysics thing? You've always been interested in earthquakes and volcanoes. Why don't you give that a try? And I went, yeah, you know what? Okay, let's give it a whirl. And the rest is history.
I must say your mother was very prescient.
Absolutely.
Her to choose geophysics as opposed to geology or physics.
Well, I mean, I was doing A-level physics, and I didn't take A-level geology at all, and I suppose the exposure that I had to geology was in geography courses. It was this blend of the experimental part of the physics A-level that I really enjoyed, and this fascination I had with earthquakes and volcanoes and the like. When I got to university, I then realised that, as you've alluded to already, there are other branches of geophysics. And so I kind of moved a little bit away from the earthquakes and volcanoes and got more involved with the exploration side and the kind of the use of geophysics to detect things and to characterise things and to find out what's in the ground or the snow or the ice or whatever it happens to be beneath your feet.
I mean, here in Texas, that's what mainly people think about exploration.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? I mean, and you'd think, what are they still exploring the Permian Basin for? But there's still things to be discovered.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And this hydraulic fracturing that's sort of booming right now, it's getting ever closer to El Paso, which is a desert area, but I mean, we don't have very much in the way of petroleum reserves deep down, except very deep, probably.
Yeah.
But it's getting closer, and this is all to do with geophysics beginning to do the basic study.
Absolutely. You know, it's a growth industry and a controversial growth industry within the UK. But indeed, geophysical surveys are required to do the initial kind of geological snapshot of what's down there, and then ultimately to try and predict how much reserves are down there. But I would say exploration geophysics moves beyond your kind of petroleum and hydrocarbon resources and goes into water resources, goes into minerals, and goes into kind of engineering studies. Like, if you want to redevelop a site, you need to map out where all the pipes and the cables, estimates of depth of bedrock are, so that you can build a solid foundation. Any kind of site remediation like that is going to need a geophysical survey. And a lot of the time, that's where I come in.
You just mentioned hydraulic fracturing in Britain.
Mm.
Just give me a quick update, because I know my sister and my family all live in Sussex, and there was some talk about Sussex being a prime location until all of the good middle-class conservative people down in Sussex said, hell, not in my home territory.
Absolutely.
The local MP came on and said something along the lines of, oh, why would you want to do hydraulic fracking or fracturing in this lovely area? Why don't you send them somewhere up to the barren northeast or northwest?
Thank you very much. Yeah,
absolutely. What a crass comment.
It's terrible. I mean, it's such an emotive subject because people see it as the violation of England's green and pleasant land and things like this. And I can kind of see it from both sides of the coin, having both interests within environmental applications of geoscience, but also understanding the need for a sustainable economy, the need for employment. I would take a lesson from the Witch Farm field, which is in underneath Poole Harbour.
I don't know this.
No, that's fine. So Poole Harbour is an area of outstanding natural beauty on the south coast of the UK. It is stunning. But beneath Poole Harbour is a producing hydrocarbon field, one of the largest onshore fields in Europe. And you'd never know about it, and indeed people don't, because when it's properly managed, it's not incompatible that you would have heavy industry alongside this really beautiful, picturesque White Cliffs coast. And if you know what you're looking for, you can see one producing tower on a man-made island in the harbour. But the rest of the facility is, it's all tree-lined. You can't actually see it. And so, for me, the risks that come from fracking, I think, are emotive, but I think we need to understand them better. So the government moratorium on fracking activities was over-egged, I think. But in terms of the environmental risk, I do think that can be managed and it's not incompatible.
Well, I think there's a lot to be said on that topic, but I don't want to go into it with you. Other than now, when I go back to the southwest of England, I'm going to go to Poole Harbour.
And see if you can spot the tower.
Right, absolutely. So let's go back then to your particular role as a geophysicist. And I know you've been doing work on glaciers. Mm-hmm. You do work on archaeology too. But let's just concentrate for a moment on glaciers and what's the issue? What are you bringing to the table? What are you trying to understand?
Yeah, okay, cool. So as we've already said, geophysics is about subsurface exploration and trying to understand the ground beneath your feet, or in this case, the ice beneath your feet. And it all feeds into the discussion and the debate about climate change, global warming and sea level rise. If we have an idea about how the Antarctic, for example, is going to evolve in the face of warming global temperatures, we need to understand what the start point is. And this is really where the geophysics comes in. So we can go to Antarctica, we can do geophysical surveys, we can characterize, in the first instance, simply how thick is the ice there. But then with more subtle analyses, you can work out questions like, what is the ice sat on? Because ice that is sat on, say, welded to its bedrock, will flow and will move in a very different way to ice that is sat on slippery mud and sediment. You can imagine that as you increase the water content at the bottom of the glacier, you reduce the friction, and so the ice will kind of slip and slide through this mud, and it will flow faster.
So, I mean, this sort of fits into what most people have seen. Everyone in the world who's got access to photographs has seen pictures of glaciers around the world receding.
Yeah.
Right? But this is just one snapshot from above.
That's right.
And you've got no clue about the depth.
Yep.
All right? And so the little bit that you see is removing may be a minuscule part of the whole volume.
Absolutely.
Or it could be a major part. Yep. So what you're saying is that using geophysics, you can learn a lot about the depth.
Yep.
And you can also, can you learn about what is the bedrock, whether it's slippery, whether it's not? Well, tell us.
Yeah, you can do this. So I don't know how scientific to get here, so stop me if I'm maybe talking in jargon. But for example, when we send a seismic wave through the ice, it will reflect from the glacier bed. There's a physical material contrast there that causes the energy to be reflected back to surface.
So it's going through just ice rather rapidly, I suppose.
3,800 metres per second.
I thought it was something like that. And then it reflects off, and then this is what you can get.
That's right.
Now, of course, the reflection isn't just a plain mirror. I mean,
there's
geography
rocks and
there.
Bumps and things down there, yeah. But it's the material contrast at the bottom of the glacier that gives us the strength of the reflection. So if we have ice over bedrock, now ice and bedrock geophysically are rather similar beasts, so you might expect that there would be a small reflection coefficient, as we say. So a small proportion of energy bounces from the glacier bed, and the rest of it just carries on into the bedrock.
Why is that such a similarity? Ice is an open structural arrangement of water molecules.
I know
they're tightly bound.
Sure.
But you tend to think of rock, you know, that's pretty solid.
Well, the ice is pretty solid too.
Yeah.
You know, once it's been, it's compressed down there in the bottom of Antarctica. And so you get the stronger contrast if you've got this liquid water, if you've got slippery mud that has, you know, a lot more porosity. There's a lot less kind of crystalline rock within that volume.
And so your signal can be absorbed. Is that part of it?
That's part of it. But, well, what we'll actually see is that because there's a stronger contrast at that glacier bed, there'll be more energy reflected back to the surface. So on a very simple level, by just looking at how strong your reflection is, you can start to kind of diagnose what the material properties beneath the glacier must be.
How do you know the depth?
It's all a travel time relationship. So if you know the speed that the energy is traveling through the ice, and that's usually pretty fixed, and even if it wasn't, we can measure it anyway. When we fire the seismic source, whether this is hammer and plate, you know, a simple sledgehammer and you give the glacier a whack, whether it's a small explosive charge, you can time how long it takes that charge, the energy from that charge, to travel across your network of sensors. And so you know how far away they are, you know the travel time, speed is distance over time.
Okay.
You can work out how fast the energy is traveling. So this then, you say, well, what would you do with that information? The Geophysical Survey informs predictive computer models of the evolution of the system. So if you know the starting scenario, and you would say, okay, well, I think over here the glacier is underlain by bedrock, over here it's underlain by this soft sediment and mud. If I start to evolve the system in a certain way, if I start to add more meltwater down at the bottom of the glacier, how's that going to start to evolve? And so the best computer models of glacier flow and how they're going to melt and how they're going to evolve are all informed by the most accurate descriptions of the whole system in the first place.
So a study like this, to be really comprehensive, has to be temporal. I mean, this is not a one-shot deal.
If I can use the shot to give
you the wave going down.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you've got to come back over a period of years to really begin to understand what is happening at the surface between the ice and whatever it is at the bottom.
That's right. So you've only got a finite
resource.
It's a career, for God's sake. Absolutely, of course, yeah. You've only got a finite resource. And so what you can do is, if you can take, say, the satellite archive, so, you know, every 10 days you get an updated image, and you'll see that the glacier moves in a certain way. You can track crevasses in the surface of the glacier, and then you get an idea of where they're moving and how they're changing, how they're speeding up. And if you can understand the controls on that from, say, you know, these fairly irregular snapshots of geophysical information, you can start to piece it all together. So you might not have your continuous, really high-resolution geophysical record, but you can at least combine that with a continuous satellite record. And what we're starting to do now is more and more to address this geophysically as well with kind of permanent seismic monitoring stations. But this is kind of somewhat in its infancy, but I think it's the way that we'll go. So we'll have sort of permanently installed arrays down there.
And so this has to be, by definition, almost an international cooperative program.
These things don't happen with, you know, one scientist in isolation running out of his own personal lab within a university. And indeed, the case in point is why I'm here in El Paso at the moment. So I'm down here as part of the International Thwaites Glacier Collaboration. So Thwaites Glacier is a fast-flowing glacier within West Antarctica. It is seen as a real point of vulnerability for the stability of the West Antarctic ice sheet, because it can allow ocean water to access its underbelly, if you like. So it's got this vulnerable.
So there's a seepage from the ocean.
That's
back,
right.
And that could, in theory, facilitate.
Right. So what happens at Thwaites kind of starts to propagate inside the interior, and then we might have sea level rise problems.
Okay, so now, Adam, you just sort of set us up for the Thwaites Glacier.
Okay.
We're going to take a short break and we'll be back. You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Adam Booth from the University of Leeds in good old Yorkshire, England. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Adam Booth from the University of Leeds, Department of Geology or Exploration Geophysics, should I say correctly.
That'll do.
So you were talking about this Thwaites, Thwaites glacier, and its significance. And one of the features you just mentioned at the end is that somehow there's the capacity for underflow of this by oceanic.
That's right.
Talk about that, because one tends to forget that a glacier that starts on bedrock, if it's big enough and can permeate and move until it's over seawater. Not a lot of people think about that, but that's, tell us about that nature of those glaciers and what you're looking at.
So what you find around a lot of the Antarctic continent is that you get these terrestrial glaciers, and rather than just ending where the land ends, they can extend out over the ocean in what we call an ice shelf. And at the end of the ice shelf, you get a whole series of iceberg calving events. So that's one mechanism by which Antarctica loses ice to the oceans. Now, Thwaites Glacier has another element to it, in that you normally expect that the glacier surface slopes down towards the sea and also underneath the glacier bed, so the bedrock or the sediments beneath the glacier also slope down towards the sea. Thwaites has the reverse situation. So Thwaites is on what we call a retrograde bed slope, which means that when you arrive at the Thwaites shore, the bedrock will actually be sloping down away from you. Now, if you think, water flows downhill, right? So the ocean water potentially has an access into the interior of the Antarctic continent. Well, yeah, and if Thwaites thins a little bit, then it's got a higher tendency to float. So if you imagine you're slowly peeling back Thwaites Glacier such that water is able to get underneath Thwaites Glacier, it will then flow downhill and it will start to change the bed conditions in the interior of the Antarctic continent. And this is why Thwaites not only is sensitive in its own right, it potentially influences the rest of the West Antarctic ice sheet. So there are lots of kind of doom and gloom scenarios about what might happen to Antarctic ice. Thwaites Glacier is potentially one route that they could become a reality. It really is quite a vulnerable part of the Antarctic system.
Before we get into what's happening down there, let's just ask a simple question. Okay, the water underneath the piece that's promontory onto the water, what's the temperature?
It very, very cold. We were actually watching a video the other day that was made by an NSF diver working around McMurdo Station, which is the US, the main US base within Antarctica. And he's swimming in water that's, you know, a fraction of a degree above freezing, so much so that you can see ice crystals floating around within the water column, and you get ice crystals growing on the seabed.
The point is that thinking about chemistry for a moment, saline water is going to have a much higher, lower melting point.
Yes.
And so is a lot of the water underneath the glacier colder than freezing 0 degrees centigrade, 32 Fahrenheit?
It's hypersaline, it's colder. The problem is that that's only part of the problem, because when you start getting climate change, it's not just the ice that's affected. There's a whole coupled ocean, ice, atmosphere system. So one of the things that oceanographers are looking at is the way that Antarctic circulation in the oceans will change. So you could actually get much warmer water. It's kind of redirected up to the ice anyway. So certainly around Greenland, for example, there are cases where you get these marine terminating glaciers, and for significant parts of the year, they're kind of bathed in this
warm water
bath. Yeah. So,
but that's not yet happening, or it's not happening in Antarctica.
There is evidence that there are these kind of hot, these hot streams of water that can, well, when I say hot, I don't mean a hot spa or something like that, but relatively warm inputs of water. And I think the concern is that they could become the norm. And so then you get ice that's not only attacked by warmer air temperatures, it's also attacked by warmer ocean water.
So it's a double attack.
Absolutely.
So now I do remember, and I'm sure most people do, this word calving, that presumably a glacier of the type you're talking about, which is moved out beyond the land and is now over water, this is going to be more fragile. And you can imagine that little bits can sooner or later start breaking off.
Absolutely.
And I know there's one gigantic iceberg, if I can call it that.
Yeah.
Talk about that a little.
So, yeah, this carving mechanism is a natural process that goes on in Antarctica. And even if we weren't talking about climate change arguments, there would be icebergs that carve off. The Antarctica and Greenland and any flowing glacier is like a conveyor belt. There's an input and there's an output. They start off life as snowfall, and then they finish up as icebergs setting sail in the ocean. Some are bigger than others. The one that I've been studying
recently... Not all
recently,
icebergs are created equal.
That's right,
Thank
exactly.
Thank you, George Orwell.
Absolutely. Some are carved in very, very different colossal fashions. Larsen Sea Ice Shelf is one of these floating sections of ice in the Antarctic Peninsula. So if your listeners want to join me, you put your right hand up, you make a fist and you stick your thumb out. And so on the pad of your thumb, that's Larsen Sea Ice Shelf. In July 2017, Larsen C carved one of the biggest icebergs that we ever seen. It was christened Iceberg A68. 5,000 or so square kilometres in area, so what's that? 3,500 square miles, I would guess, something
That's
like
about
that.
About the size of Wales.
It's you know, the state size. It's the size of Delaware. Was the official statistic that got released. You know, this is Delaware sized.
So this was an American scientist who
probably so.
This.
Yeah, because no one in the UK
Delaware.
Really knows.
Delaware.
Also, for the Europeans amongst us, it was twice the size of Luxembourg. But even
okay.
still,
that's Georgia, it's a big one.
It's a big one, really big.
So what's happening to it?
So, well, at the moment, it's kind of sat around the Weddell Sea, slowly making its way out into the southern oceans. But rather than the iceberg itself, that started to call into question the overall stability of Larsen C. So it doesn't take a great leap of the imagination to imagine that if there's a Larsen C, then there's also a Larsen B and a Larsen A. And Larsen B, in 2002, for example, underwent this catastrophic collapse where it over a matter of weeks, it disintegrated into thousands of small icebergs. And that's it. The ice shelf hasn't since regrown. And what seemed to have kicked off that sequence of events is potentially, at least, a large iceberg carving event. And if you look back in the satellite record, you can see that there's a large iceberg that is released from Larsen B, and then over the next 10, 15 years, there is this tendency towards instability. Yeah, so one of the mechanisms is that in becoming awash with this meltwater, the meltwater essentially, once it gets deep enough, exerts enough pressure that it fractures its way through the ice, and then there's this chain reaction. The whole stress state changes and you get this disintegration.
But this is a normal process too. I mean, carving is always going to occur.
Yep, yep.
Was it simply the magnitude of this particular piece of ice that got people thinking?
Or? Well, I think that it's very possible that the release of these tabular icebergs is natural and the ice shelf would regrow. The problem is that under a warming climate scenario, can that ice shelf regrow? If you get this tendency towards meltwater ponding on the top of the ice shelf, does that actually mean that we're moving into a situation where ice shelves are unstable and they're not going to be a part of a warmer Antarctic system? So Larsen C, coming back to this one, the iceberg was released 18 months ago. What does that spell for the future? And at the moment, it would seem that Larsen C actually hasn't noticed it. Its stress conditions haven't changed. But obviously, if you start releasing more and more of this ice, there's going to be less and less ice to carve off. And parts of there is some worrying scenarios that whilst Larsen C didn't feel the effect of that iceberg carving event, there are areas very close to the new front of Larsen C that are very, very sensitive to changes in stress. And so if we start to affect those, maybe it's at that point where Larsen C could become unstable. So there's this very sensitive balance, and warming climates don't help that.
We've talked a lot about glaciers, but there's another aspect of your work that really fascinates me. People in different types of science need to know what's going on underneath the ground.
That's right.
All right, and geophysics and seismology is just set up to do that.
Yep.
Tell us just very quickly about meerkats.
Meerkats, yeah. So besides seismology, I also use a technique called ground penetrating radar, which is kind of a radio wave version of seismology. So it emits small pulses of radio wave energy into the ground, and they can reflect off whatever's down there. And I've done quite a lot of this work for archaeological applications, and I was called up by the BBC, and they were making a nature documentary, actually in conjunction with PBS, called Animals with Cameras. And they asked me if I thought that this radar technique could work for detecting the kind of complicated burrows of meerkats and other burrowing animals. Their idea was that they'd fabricated these really small cameras to put around around the necks of meerkats on a small collar, and they were going to let the meerkats film whatever they get up to in their burrows. But they also wanted a top-down view, so I travelled out to South Africa with them, and we got the first kind of 3D map of the layout of a meerkat burrow. So it was really fascinating and a really great project to be involved with.
Well, but what is the three-dimensional? What do meerkats do? They go down holes, that's all I know.
Yeah,
like rabbits.
Yeah, well, I mean, they sleep down there over the course of a meerkat day. And I should say that this isn't me talking as some meerkat expert. This is my observations from simply being in the field. But they get up in the morning, they hang around the burrow for a bit, but then they all go trooping out somewhere, foraging for food or whatever. And then at night, they come back and they all go underground again. The meerkat scientists, what the geophysical data showed them that was really new to them was that when you turn up at a meerkat burrow network, you can see a scattering of 15 or so holes around the place. And the meerkat ecologists don't know whether these holes just exist in their own right or whether they're interconnected down there. And the geophysical data showed that they're actually really interconnected to a very high degree.
They didn't know that before?
They didn't know that.
They didn't send down a meerkat in one hole and see it
come pop up the other one. Yeah.
See, that seems to be the most obvious way to handle the problem.
So they were saying, and this is partly why they were sceptical about this in the first place, because the team who go out and do these detailed studies and observations of meerkats had said that they'd never really seen a meerkat go down another hole and then emerge out of one 20 feet over the other side of the burrow. And so they were sceptical about what the results were showing. But when the BBC released their footage from these meerkat cameras, you could see indeed that there was all these interconnected tunnels down there. As you were sort of going down with the meerkat, you can see that above your head, there's another tunnel coming down. So it was a really unique opportunity to calibrate the geophysical response against a completely new source of information. And yeah, it's all worked really well.
Did you tell your mother about this project, and did she then say to you, just to bring the program to an end, hey love, I told you to do geophysics?
I got you there.
Yeah, right. Is she excited by your career? Talk to her a lot about it?
Yeah, I mean, they're fascinated by it, you know, the places that I get to go to. I mean, we've talked about Antarctica and South Africa, but there's umpteen other stories that I could tell you about the foreign adventures.
Adam Booth, University of Leeds, Yorkshire, England. Thank you very much for being on Science Studio. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you very much for having me.